I swiped at my eyes before hurrying through the rest of the album. Pulled out the next one, flipped quickly through that. More Will, me and Liz, and a sea of smiling faces I'd long forgotten. Closed it. On to the next one. An album filled almost entirely with crowded group shots, candid snaps taken during nights out, people changed by having been caught in action, bodies turned away. Dim lighting or a plume of cigarette smoke or spots of rain on the lens changing faces, hiding characters, obscuring identities. I went through each one, sliding my finger across the photos, as if I was following words on a page. At some point, I heard the garden gate creak from outside. My mother was back. My stomach started to growl at the anticipation of food. I found it in the third last spread from the end. There was a photo of us standing in a row. Will, Liz, me, and two girls who I think might have been in my early theatre class. One peroxide blonde, one jet black hair. A picture taken on a dance floor of some nightclub. The harsh light of the flash illuminating our sweaty faces, our dilated pupils, the shabby decor of the club beyond, all hidden from us by the dark on the night. The first thing I noticed was that Liz wasn't looking at the camera. I was standing in between her and Will, and her head was turned, looking in my direction but past me. At him. She wasn't smiling, but it was hard to read the expression on her face. The second thing I noticed was who was standing behind Liz, with one arm slung casually around her waist. The man from the CCTV images. Red baseball cap. Out with us, in a club, back then. With his arm around Liz, one of the canal killer's victims. Downstairs, keys rattled in the front door, footsteps in the hall, followed by the murmur of voices. I pulled the photo from the album and brought it close to my face, studying every detail. Who was this guy? Liz hadn't dated anyone while we were at St. John's that I could remember. Was it just some random connection at the club? Just a pose for this photograph? How could this possibly be a coincidence? It couldn't be. I had to tell Malone. I took my phone from my jeans pocket, found his number and pressed call. Somewhere in the house, a phone started ringing, my mother's voice calling up from the hall. Allison! Allison, are you up there? There's some people here to see you. Malone picked up after one ring. We're here, he said. Shaw and me, downstairs. Allison, now. They were in the kitchen. Shaw was pulling out a chair at the dining table while my mother fussed around him, producing a milk jug and matching sugar bowl, and asking him what strength he liked his tea. Malone was standing just inside the door, waiting for me. Are you all right? He asked. I nodded. He touched my arm. You sure? I remembered then. I'd been crying. I was probably all red and splotchy, puffy-eyed. Yes, fine, I said. My mother and I, we were talking. I got upset. It wasn't about before. What happened before, exactly? Just like I said in the text I sent you. Reporters and photographers outside the hotel. I couldn't go back there.
But why were you outside?
I wanted some fresh air. Malone sighed.
Well, next time let me know.
I did.
Before you leave. And then wait for me to get there so I can take you.
Don't worry, I said. I don't plan on going outside ever again. I looked over at Shaw. What's happening? Malone motioned towards the table.
Let's sit down. As long as it's hot.
Shaw was saying to my mother amidst the clinks of crockery and cutlery.
That's all I require. Don't be going to any trouble now, Mrs. Smith.
Oh, it's no trouble.
My mother turned and saw me. Allison, I got you some lunch. I'll have it later, I said. Thanks, ma'am. Shaw was sitting on the far side of the table. Malone took the seat next to him. I wondered if they were contractually obliged to always sit side by side.
We've met before, I think, my mother said to Shaw. Haven't we?
Just the once, Mrs. Smith. I came down to Cork.
The electric kettle clicked off. Tea, my mother said to Malone.
Ma'am, I said, can you, go into the other room?
But Alison, I... Well, she looked to Shaw. Shouldn't I stay?
Please. I smiled tightly at her. Thanks.
Don't worry, Shaw said to her. It's nothing serious. We'll only be a few minutes.
Well then, why can't I stay? She asked him.
Because I'm 30 years old, I said. Ma'am, please.
29, she corrected. Then she hovered, looking uncertainly at her tea-making accoutrement. Really won't be long, Shaw said with a smiley face that didn't suit him. Just a quick chat. That's all we'll be having.
I'll make the tea, I said. It's fine. There's biscuits in it. Ma'am, please.
All right, all right. She held up her hands. I'm going, I'm going.
After throwing me a look that said I'd proved her point, I was acting like a teenager. She finally, reluctantly, left the room. I poured two cups of tea and brought them to the dining table, pushing one across the tabletop to Shaw and another to Malone, before realizing I hadn't asked him if he'd wanted any. The radio was off now, I noticed, which meant it'd be easier for my mother to eavesdrop on our conversation from the other side of the door. But then Shaw said,
Do you think the lady of the house would mind if I had a smoke out the back there?
He nodded towards the patio doors, giving me the opportunity to suggest that we all move out into the garden. The chairs out there were missing their cushions, but Shaw sat on one anyway. Malone perched on the low wall that separated the patio from the higher, green level of the garden. I remained standing, facing the house, looking at my own reflection in the extension's windows.
I hear you've had quite the morning, Shaw said.
He lit his cigarette, and the smoke immediately began to drift in my direction. He waved a hand at it.
Sorry about that.
Can I have one? He raised his eyebrows in surprise.
You don't smoke.
I don't. He snorted.
Nah, neither do I.
Shaw held the packet out to me and I took one, lit it with his lighter. He watched me with a smirk on his face, that infuriating look some men who smoke give women they've just discovered do, or do sometimes, as they wait to see if we know how, if we'll actually inhale. He offered the box to Malone next, who shook his head. I made a point of taking a long first drag. Bitter tobacco taste filled my mouth. I'd smoked for a couple of years when I'd first moved to the Netherlands, on and off, eventually giving up one particular freezing January when, buoyed by New Year motivation, I couldn't face standing outside, and I refused to stink out my house. Every time I'd smoked since, it was the idea of it, the anticipation of that first drag, that was the only bit I enjoyed. But I'd bloody smoke this whole sour thing now, though, just to show Shaw. Yeah, I said. I thought the press weren't going to find out I was here.
We did our best, love. Unfortunately, their job is to find out things we don't want them to know.
I took another drag. Each one tasted worse than before. If I took long pauses between them, at least most of the cigarette would burn down by itself. They called it a date, I said.
They want to sell papers.
Shaw took a long, deep drag of his cigarette and looked to Malone, signaling for him to talk.
We want to bring Will in for a formal interview, he said.
I asked why. Malone opened his mouth to answer, but Shaw cut in before he could.
We just do, he said flatly. And he's refused.
Can he do that?
Will's already serving 5 life sentences, Malone said. Threats of further punishment are like water off a duck's back.
Look, Shaw said.
Yeah, we could arrest him, haul him in, threaten him with charges, and he could sit there and tell us no comment every 30 seconds for the rest of the day. But we'd prefer if he wanted to talk to us.
He paused to inhale. Then he pointed the lit end of the cigarette at me.
I think if you put your mind to it, you could convince him to do it.
You want me to see him again? Both men nodded. I didn't want to, but I wondered if maybe Will would know the man in the photograph. I have something for you. I pulled the print from my back jeans pocket and explained where it had come from. That's the man from the CCTV pictures, isn't it?
who was wearing the red baseball cap. And that's me, Will, and Liz on a night out somewhere in Dublin. I handed it to Malone. Will, Liz, me. We've all met him.
Jesus Christ,
Shaw breathed.
And Mickey here said you saw this guy outside your hotel as well.
Maybe, I said. He was too far away to know for sure.
Who is he?
Malone asked me. I shook my head. That I don't know, sorry. But you must have ways of finding out, right? That's a much better picture, and maybe you could find one of those other girls and they'd remember. Or maybe Will would. He hasn't seen this yet. And it tells you this guy was in or around St. John's back then. That's good, right? I mean, why would he be copying the original crimes if he didn't have some connection to the first lot?
Shaw was making a face like he'd swallowed a fly.
He could still be at St. John's, that's the problem. One of those guys who stay there getting degree after degree, postponing the real world. That would explain his midnight canal walks. He could just be going to and from campus. He could have nothing to do with this.
Shaw handed the photo to Malone. Get this to the incident room.
He might be one of the names, Malone said.
What names? I asked.
The phones have been hopping since we released the CCTV images. We collate all the names supplied and make a list of the ones that come up again and again. We can't check everyone, so that's how we narrow it down.
Malone,
Shaw said warningly. Malone turned and went inside. I watched through the glass as he walked through the kitchen and out into the hall. I didn't know if he was leaving, but I was afraid that he might be. When I turned back to Shaw, he was stubbing out his cigarette and watching me watch Malone.
He's very chatty altogether, Shaw said, isn't he?
I knew by chatty he meant overly generous with details of Garda investigations. I feigned ignorance.
Is he? Do you believe him?
He took the cigarette packet out of his pocket and started to light another,
Hurley in his little innocence spiel.
My cigarette was finally done. I flicked the butt into one of my mother's plant pots and sat down on the spot of the wall Malone had vacated, feeling a little lightheaded from the smoke. I don't have to believe him, I said. It's not up to me. I'm not the one handing down judgments.
Shaw snorted. You're saying if Hurley was innocent but still stuck inside, it wouldn't bother you because you're not the one handing down judgments.
Is he?
What?
Innocent?
No.
Shaw met my eye and we stared at each other for an uncomfortably long moment. I felt like he was waiting for me to break, for tears to come, for some other truth to burst out. But I held my nerve.
He is guilty, Shaw said, hoisting himself out of the chair, and should be in a prison, but nah. We have him in the CPH because he's,
Shaw made air quotes,
depressed. So they put him with a therapist 3 times a week and give him some colouring pencils or whatever it is they do. At least the holiday's over soon. Off to Clover Hill he goes. You know what's ironic? If you consider the turnover of staff in the CPH and the sheer number of them Will encounters there on a day-to-day basis, he's had more contact with people who live in the outside world than he would have had with his fellow prisoners if he'd been in Clover Hill all this time.
What does that have to...
Back in 2007, we found this girl, right?
Shaw started pacing around the patio, waving his cigarette around as he talked.
Heather Buckley. She'd been mugged walking home early one Sunday morning after a night in the town during Freshers' Week. Attempted mugging, I should say, because 2 guys out for a dawn cycle came upon the scene while the incident was in progress, and the guy ran off. They didn't get a good look at him, but nothing in the description they did give would rule Will Hurley out. And this happened by the canal, and Heather was in St. John's.
He was standing in front of me now, and he stopped there to tell me the next part.
I think that was his first attempt, thwarted by the 2 Lycra lads. Here's what's interesting, though. Heather said that the guy who ran off wasn't her attacker. He was actually a good Samaritan, who'd stopped to see if she was all right, prompting her actual attacker to run off. But when the cyclists came on the scene, the Samaritan runs off himself. What does that tell you?
I'm sorry, I said. I'm not following.
There's boy A and boy B, right? Boy A attacks the girl. Boy B comes along and scares Boy A off, thereby leaving Boy B alone with the girl. She thinks he's a nice guy, stopped to help a girl out. Her knight in shining armor. Then maybe he offers to walk her home. Maybe he offers her his couch while they wait for the guards to arrive. Or this is 2007, so maybe he says you can use my landline. Landlines, eh? Remember those? My point is, he's got her, this Boy B. She trusts him. And if Boy A and Boy B are buddies, well...
Shaw looked at me pointedly. You think they were working together? I said. And that the cyclists ruined their plan. And that one of them was Will and the other was the guy who's out there. The new cases.
Clever girl.
Shaw took a deep drag, even though his cigarette was already down to the filter, and I could see the paper glowing dangerously red against his fingers.
Have you ever considered a career in An Garda Síochána?
That's ridiculous.
I know. The hours are terrible and the pay is shite.
I meant your theory. He coughed loudly, a wet, phlegmy sound.
I even had a code name at the ready. Operation Gentleman. What do you think?
I think you should probably stop smoking.
It would explain a lot, wouldn't it?
Like how he manages to incapacitate these girls and get them into the water 5 feet from a busy road in the dead of night when a splash would be a loud noise, and then walk away, soaked to the bone. Shaw paused to cough again.
I think it's quite clever, actually. Tag-teaming. One attacks, the other saves. But the one who saves is the real attacker.
And then what?
Who knows? Maybe they both come back to do the deed, or maybe they'd take turns being the good guy.
More coughing. Shaw was going a little red in the face and his eyes were watering.
Now, maybe I'm wrong. That girl had been through something and she was upset. Maybe the guy ran away because one of the Lycra lads was his dad, or his older brother, and it was 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and his eyes were like bloody saucers. It's just a theory. But because our Willy boy has got a case of the SADS and is in the CPH, he's easier to get to than he would be in prison. If he needed to, you know, plan something. Do you see what I'm getting at, love?
You think he might have got to Will in there? The new killer?
Exactly. We've checked all visitation applications, no joy. But I know the first thing I'll be doing with that photo is checking it against their employee records. This morning I got them to search Will's room. I've got guys going through all the correspondence he saved, just in case.
Have you talked to that Heather girl?
She was never able to provide us with a detailed description.
You could show her the photo now, I suggested.
We will.
So when do I go?
Home.
To the CPH. Shaw looked at me sideways while stubbing out his cigarette.
You're saying you'll go?
I stood up, pausing to check the light-headed feeling had passed. I want to know who the guy in the photo is, too.
One more thing, Shaw said. I've been in this job a long time. I can't tell you how many times I knew a guy wasn't telling me the truth, but I didn't have the evidence to prove it. You can't just go in and tell the judge, I know he's lying, unfortunately. Now, with Hurley, we did have the evidence. We had forensics and his little stalker manual, which, helpfully, he was keeping in his own locker. But even before that, I knew we had our guy, because from the moment he came into that interview room, I knew he was lying to us.
He stepped closer.
There's no case where everything fits together perfectly, love, okay? You never get all the dots to join. That's just the nature of the beast. Hurley, he might say things to you that make you think, hang on a second, there could be something here. But trust me, that's not what we think when we hear them. We think, oh, okay, this is just like any other case then. You're always going to have discrepancies.
Like what?
Well, I'm sure Will's already provided you with a highlights reel. Let me guess. We forced him to confess. The blood was planted. He'd never seen that folder before in his life.
Pretty much, I said. Yeah.
It's all bullshit, love.
Shaw's expression had softened, and his tone was more gentle now.
I'm just trying to help you, you know. Get you back to Holland in one piece.
You said you knew Will was lying when he came in for the interview. Before you found the stuff in his locker and the blood?
Yeah.
What made you bring Will in the first place, then?
Shaw hesitated a moment. Then he said, he was on our list.
What list?
The list of suspects.
But why?
Shaw looked away into the kitchen. Well, he knew Liz Whelan.
So did a lot of people.
Yeah, well, a lot of people had alibis.
For when? For the night of Liz's murder?
For all of the nights, all of the murders.
And Will didn't.
Shaw looked back at me. Why do you ask?
Now I hesitated. I don't really remember the order of events, I said then. It's all a bit of a blur to me.
I can understand that. By the way, thank you.
Shaw said this with an uncharacteristic sincerity.
For doing this, for coming here, you did the right thing.
Well, that's okay.
Now, if you could just get Will to have a little chat with us, I'd really appreciate it, Alison, really.
When you knocked on my door, you didn't think he actually had any information, did you? You thought it was a waste of time.
I most certainly did.
Then why bother asking me to come here at all?
It was for him.
Shaw nodded towards the house.
Mickey boy. He was beating himself up over Louise Farrington. He wanted to exhaust every possible avenue. I was just letting him.
And now? Shaw frowned.
What?
You haven't sent me home yet.
Well, now that you're here, love, we may as well make use of you, eh?
Shaw grinned. Yeah. I smiled back. You know something?
What?
You're pretty chatty too. I turned on my heel and went inside. Malone was coming through the kitchen. Any relief I felt at his still being here instantly dissipated when he said,
we need to go. We have a female St. John's first year missing since last night.
The pressure in his skull is so bad he fantasizes about the bone cracking open, seizures starting at the crown and spreading out in all directions, releasing it. Releasing him. He punches two chalky tablets out of a blister pack and swallows them with a mouthful of cloudy water from the kitchen sink, wincing at the bitter taste when one of them begins to dissolve on his tongue. Sweat collects at his hairline and under his arms. He wipes at his forehead with a sheet of cheap paper towels and puts on his blazer to hide the damp patches on his shirt. He rests his palms on the kitchen counter, leans his weight against it, closes his eyes, tries to convince himself the blackness brings at least a slight relief. When he opens them again, he sees the garden shed, 30 feet away at the end of the garden. The window over the sink frames it perfectly. The shed sits at an angle, its front directed a few degrees away from the back of the house, and from this vantage point, he notices something he didn't before. It has a large window set into its left side. The doorbell rings. They're early. The man on the stoop is friendly, all smiles. The woman next to him is straining her neck to see into the hall, a sour expression on her face, as if the house is a muddy field she's going to have to navigate in nice shoes. As he checks their names against his appointment book and welcomes them to the house, he feels the woman's eyes wander onto his forehead, to the beads of sweat he knows must be glistening there. This only makes him sweat more. When he turns to lead them down the hall into the kitchen, he feels a warm stream of it sneak down his spine and pool in the small of his back. The pain in his head throbs in time with his pulse. It hurts to think. Although his spiel is well practiced, he's not sure he can deliver it just now. He needs the pills to kick in to sand down the sharp edges of the pain. So he hands over one of his glossy brochures and suggests they go explore the house by themselves. He says he'll meet them after, here, in the kitchen, to answer any questions they may have. He suggests they start upstairs and work their way down. He tells them to take their time. As soon as they've left the room, he drops into one of the chairs at the dining table and puts his head in his hands, willing the pulsating in his brain to slow or stop. It's been developing for the past hour, threatening since the middle of last night. He should have taken something for it hours ago. He hears the woman's voice in the hall mutter, "Fucking shit, Tip. You have to use your imagination, Em. And that guy looks like he has Ebola. Shh." He can barely think through the pain. He knows the pills will start to dull it soon, but what until then? The kitchen starts to feel like it's spinning. He pulls one of the brochures towards him and tries to focus on the text, a steady center in all the movement. R&P estate agents are proud to present this superb three-bedroom semi-detached home in this ever-popular, mature and sought-after location. The property is close to all amenities and offers easy access to the M50, public transport links and all main arteries through the city and beyond. Accommodation is over two floors, the centrepiece being an open-plan kitchen-slash-living space which offers flexible options to suit any style of living, thus enabling the purchaser to tailor their new home to their family's needs and put their own stamp on the property. It benefits from a south-facing garden, ample off-street parking and built-in storage in all three bedrooms. The main bathroom requires some modernization, but it is a sizable space with great potential. The previous owners began the conversion of the attic space into a fourth bedroom, a project which, when complete, will offer panoramic views over South Dublin. Welcome home. He wrote it himself, so he knows what it really means. R&P estate agents will pretend to be proud to present anything you pay us to, including this musty, neglected, bog-standard three-bedroom semi. The housing market being the way it is, we could park a septic tank in the shell of a burnt-out house anywhere between the sea and the motorway and get more than the asking price from one of the hundreds who queue up to view it. Easy access to the M50? Sure. But only before 8 in the morning and after 7 at night, because there's about 15 sets of traffic lights to get through before you get to the on-ramp. Since you're going to have to gut the place entirely, you might as well make it look the way you like. You can start with removing the storage upstairs, which comes in the form of unsightly 1970s-era built-ins that dominate every room to the point of oppression. They actually finished the attic conversion, but never secured planning permission for it, so we can't say they did. Bonus. The ceiling up there is so dramatically sloped that the Velux window is at chest height, so if you bend down a bit, you'll get a view of a sea of slate roofs and, beyond them, the monstrous eyesore that is the new incinerator at Poolbeg. The welcome home bit was the boss's idea. All the agents added with an eye roll to the end of every property description R&P put out. He hears footsteps directly above his head, dull thumps on the bare floorboards in the master bedroom. He folds his arms on the tabletop and rests his head on them. He wishes he could sleep. He will when they leave. He'll take a nap. There's an old blanket in the boot of his car. He can put it on one of the cold, damp beds upstairs and lie down on top. He slides into the bliss of that idea. That's all he needs. To sleep for a while. He's been up all night. A couple of hours of it and he'll be able to think clearly. Then he can sort everything out. He just needs to sleep. Footsteps on the decking outside. He wakes up with a jolt, nearly knocking over the chair he was sitting on in his rush to get to the kitchen window. The couple are outside in the back garden. They must have gone out through the double doors in the living room. He must have dozed off. The man is walking towards the shed. The pills are working hard to dull the pain, making him groggy. He struggles to turn the lock in the double doors here in the kitchen and half stumbles out onto the deck. The woman is out there flipping through the brochure. "So no garage," she says to him. "I didn't see one." He answers automatically. There's certainly space for it. The man is at the shed now. The padlock on the door glints in the sunshine. But it's not the door that worries him. It's that side window.
I think they're taking that with them, he calls out as he starts down the garden, trying not to look like he's hurrying.
The man turns, frowns at him.
The shed? Really? Do people do that?
Sometimes, yes. Have you seen the side entrance?
Yeah, on our way in.
Your wife was asking about a garage.
Wife? The man repeats.
He smiles.
She'll love that.
Oh, is she not? We're not married, no. The woman is standing on the decking, shielding her eyes from the sun, looking at them.
Why don't we go back inside? He suggests. You two can take a closer look at the kitchen.
The man hesitates. He looks at the shed again.
Yeah. Filled with junk, that thing is.
He points at it. Right to the door. They'll have a hell of a time clearing it out before they move it. I don't envy them. The man nods.
Probably a good thing they're taking it with them. I do exactly the same thing.
He laughs and starts back up the garden, back towards the house. Away from the shed. Finally. On the deck, the woman is looking bored and impatient. She starts walking toward the man.
They're taking the shed,
he tells her, raising his voice to cover the distance between them. She makes a face.
Do people do that?
When both halves of the couple are within feet of the deck again, he goes to the shed's door and tugs on the padlock, double-checking. Locked. Then he goes to the window, which is grimy and partially blocked by a stack of shelves inside, but still offers a narrow view of the interior of the shed. The wheeled plastic garbage bin is still standing there. Property of St. John's College, it says on the side. At the sight of it, the pain in his head throbs harder. It's all gone wrong, and he's not sure how to make it right. He turns and heads back to the house.
Alison, now. When Malone said we, of course he meant he and Shaw needed to leave. What about Will? I asked. Am I still going to see him?
Maybe one of the local lads could bring her, Shaw suggested to Malone. Yeah, maybe. He turned to me. Leave it with us.
When do you think?
It'll be a few hours at least.
You're taking the picture, I said. I won't be able to show it to him.
I don't want you showing him, Shaw said. We, indicating him and Malone, need to see Will's reaction for ourselves, and we need to record it. I want a formal interview. That's what you can do. Get him to talk to us.
I'll call you, Malone said to me. After they left, my mother made lunch for both of us, peppering me with questions about what the detectives and I had talked about between bites. I dutifully filled her in, sticking to the bullet points. A girl is missing, I said then. A first year from St. John's. Oh, no, my mother shook her head. God, that's awful. Her poor parents. Imagine what they must be thinking. She started clearing the plates. I'll put on the news. They might have something on about it. I had no interest if they did. Can I take a shower, ma'am?
A shower? She smiled. I have something much better than that, love.
Turns out my mother's newfound love for interior design extended to indulging in luxury bathroom features as well. She led me upstairs, to the ensuite off the master bedroom, and then motioned for me to go in so I'd discover it for myself. A giant, freestanding bathtub that almost came up to my hip. There was a wire shelf set across it, providing a resting place for various bottles of bubble bath and maybe a book.
I situate your father downstairs, she said, and I come up here, put in my bubbles, pour a nice glass of wine, and then I have the Kindle, but do you know what I do with it? I put it in a Ziploc bag. Isn't that a good idea? You can have that one for free.
I couldn't help but laugh.
Ma'am, what is all this?
The house, the bath, the garden. Did you guys win the lotto or something and decide not to tell me?
No, I just... You know.
She gave a little shrug. What else would I be doing? I have to occupy my time somehow. She smiled, denoting it a joke, but the translation I heard was, my only child refuses to come visit, and grandkids? What are those? I was beginning to see that I wasn't the only one who'd lost a part of herself to the past. My mother left me with soft towels and an array of smelly things, and only after I told her 3 times, no, really, I wouldn't have any wine. The tub took forever to fill, but the wait was worth it. Sinking my shoulders beneath the hot, rose-scented water was a moment of pure, unadulterated bliss. I closed my eyes. I thought of Will. My phone began to ring. I'd left it on a face cloth on the wire shelf. I pulled myself up out of the water again to check the screen. Sal. Before I could think too much about what would happen next, I picked up the phone and answered it.
Ali, sorry, I didn't expect you to answer. I was just going to leave a message. Are you okay? What's going on? Can you talk?
Sal, it was so nice to hear her voice. It felt like an age since I'd spoke to her last, and for us, it really was. Sal, listen, there's something I need to tell you.
What's wrong?
Her words were sharp with concern. I'm fine, physically fine anyway. Everyone is. The reason I'm here... I came here because... I didn't know where to start. It's a really long story.
I have time.
I should have told you it long ago.
That's okay, she said, although she sounded a little uncertain. You're telling me now.
It's about something that happened before I came to the Netherlands. It's why I came to the Netherlands, actually.
Ali, whatever this is, do you want to tell me it? Don't feel you have to.
No, I do. I want to. I bit my lip. Tears were threatening. I need to, Sal.
Well, I'm listening.
It would be better, I decided, to do this quickly. All in one go. Rip off the band-aid. I took a deep breath. I went to college in Ireland, I said. For 1 year before I went in Den Haag, a place called St. John's here in Dublin. And while I was there, there was a series of murders. 5 girls. There's this canal that runs through the city, right by the campus, and each of them, they'd been walking home late at night and someone had attacked them, pushed them in.
I think I remember that, Sal said. I remember seeing something about it on Sky News. They got the guy, though, right? The one who was doing it. Wasn't he a student there too or something?
Yes, I said. And that was the last word I got out before the tears came. The sounds of my crying travelling down the line.
Yes, he was. Ali, what's wrong? Did you know one of them? One of the girls?
Since primary school. Her name was Liz.
Oh, no. God, I'm so sorry. That must have been awful.
She paused.
But why am I only hearing this now? Why wouldn't you tell me that?
Because...
Just say it. Just tell her. Just do it.
Because I knew him, too. There was a moment of silence. By the time Sal asked,
how?
I was beginning to panic, beginning to fear that what came next was judgment. Disgust and disbelief. But it was too late to turn back now.
We were,
I wiped at my eyes with the back of my free hand.
We were together, Sal. I loved him.
In a rush, I blurted out the newest chapter in the story. A copycat killer. The Gardaí asking me to talk to Will. Me coming to Dublin and discovering that maybe what I thought had happened back then wasn't the real story. Or at least not all of it. Me wondering if Will really was who they said he was, or who I'd thought he was back then.
Best case scenario, I said. He had an accomplice, which means I'm an even bigger idiot than I thought I was, because I didn't see anything ever that pointed to that. So not only was this killer right under my nose, in my bed, but this whole other clandestine operation was going on around me as well. And I've stepped back into all this for nothing, and he's fooled me yet again, because I've been second-guessing everything, thinking that he's... I took a breath, exhaled. And that's the worst-case scenario, Sal. That he's innocent. That he didn't do these things. That I thought he could have... That he had hurt Liz. And I ran away, I abandoned him, and he's been in there all this time, rotting, losing the best years of his life, and I... My voice cracked. I can't even deal with the prospect of that. I don't know what I expected Sal to say to this, but it certainly wasn't. I'm getting on a plane. I'm coming to you. What? I could hear noises, like her moving stuff around a desk. It was Monday afternoon. She'd be at work. Sal, no. Is there an evening flight from Schiphol? Or maybe Eindhoven? I could get Dirk to drive me there. Sal, wait. No, seriously, there's no need. Are you kidding? Sal, I said, really, I love you and you're amazing. That's amazing that you would do that. But you don't need to come here. I'd never ask you to. You didn't ask. But I'm coming back tomorrow, so there's no point, really. I mean it. Are you sure? I could just go for the night and then come back with you. Are you flying back into Schiphol? If I came to you now, then you wouldn't have to come down on the train by yourself when you get back. We don't even have to train it. We could get Dirk to collect us. You're really hell-bent on getting Dirk to drive somewhere, aren't you? Sal laughed. Look, I'm sure. There's no need. Thank you, though. Okay, well, phew, Sal said. I didn't see Line of Duty last night, and I was really looking forward to watching it after work. I'd have resented you for delaying it. For a long time, and so would Dirk, because I told them if he watches it without me, that's like automatic divorce. I smiled and felt the warmth of it spread across my chest. I should have called Sal long before now. She was a welcome breeze of normality wafting through all this stuff. She was my normality, reminding me that this wasn't my life, but a mere detour from it, and as soon as I returned to Breda, everything would be all right again. So long as this time, I got myself some closure first. I don't know what to do. Careful not to drop the phone, I leaned back against the cool ceramic of the bath. Tell me what I should do, please. What are the options? I'm not even sure. Well, talk to me. Can you just leave? Come home now? No, I have to go see him again, later. They want me to convince him to be formally interviewed. They? The Gardaí. Do you really have to, though? I don't know, to be honest. No, but I want to. Why? I thought of the photograph. There's something I want to ask him. Were you still dealing with this when I first met you? Well, yeah. It had just happened at the start of that summer. Shit, Ali. I'm so sorry. It's not your fault. I wish you'd have told me. We could have talked about it. I should have, but I was mortified, Sal. About what? About not knowing. I mean, how stupid you have to be in love with a person who murders other people and not know about it. Murder, Sal. What kind of a person do you have to do that? And he did it 5 times. Well, Sal said, and I just knew by her tone a joke was coming. I will have to stop accusing you of being too picky. I rolled my eyes, but I was smiling. I can't believe you just said that. Humour's how I deal, okay? Deal with it. But seriously. Seriously? Ali, he murdered 5 girls. That's at least 4 murders the police didn't solve right away. 4 times they failed to catch him. And they're the police. There's hundreds of them. You were just 1 teenage girl. How in God's name could you have known? I didn't have an answer for this, only that no matter which way I looked at things, I still felt like I should have. Did you say he confessed? Sal asked then. Yes. I'm just asking the question here, but
doesn't that make his guilt pretty cut and dry?
That's what I used to think.
A beat passed. Used to.
Apparently the confession was coerced. It's false. Or it could be.
That's what he says anyway. And there's this detective here, Malone, who seems to think there might be something to it. That Will might be innocent, and that the quote-unquote real killer is the one out there now, doing it again.
Why does he think that?
In Ireland, if you plead guilty, there's no trial. Malone says because of that, the evidence against Will wasn't... interrogated, is the word he used. There wasn't a lawyer in a courtroom somewhere defending Will saying, yeah, okay, but what about this?
That's his name, Will.
It was strange to hear his name spoken in Sal's voice. It had always been this gulf between us, this dark void, and Sal hadn't even known it was there. At least, no matter what happened now, I had closed that up and let her in. I'd finally told her everything.
Almost.
Yeah, I said. Will.
How long were you together?
Sal asked.
All of first year.
Well, up until he was arrested.
That happened at the start of May, so about 9 months.
What was he like?
No one had ever asked me that without hoping I'd unconsciously reveal some trait that absolutely pointed to him being a serial killer. Sal, I knew, just genuinely wanted to know.
He was great. Kind and smart and funny and caring. And gorgeous, I thought. I'd say I spent our entire time together just totally distracted by him. I couldn't concentrate on anything else. He was my first proper boyfriend, so there was that too, but still. I'd never met anyone like him before. I haven't since. He was just... he was perfect. I mean, nobody's perfect, but for me, to me, he was.
I paused. I think this is where one of us uses the phrase, too good to be true.
Okay, so look, Sal said, the police. They're trying to catch this new guy, right?
Right.
And if they do, and if the new guy admits he killed the girls 10 years ago, that will prove Will's innocence.
If and if, then yes.
But otherwise, Will is guilty. I mean, it's not like you can prove his guilt or innocence, right? Not by yourself.
No.
Are you trying to?
No, I said again. Although I wasn't sure. I'd gone looking through my photographs, hadn't I? I told myself it was because I wanted to know where I knew the CCTV guy from.
But was that the real reason?
Ali, you say you don't know what to do, but really, you shouldn't be doing anything at all. You don't have to. All you need to think about is how you're going to react to however this turns out. I mean, do you want your life to change? Do you want to ditch your job, move back to Ireland and live with Will happily ever after?
God, no. The idea was preposterous. I couldn't even picture it, let alone examine whether or not I wanted it. No, not at all. That's not what this is about.
Then what is it about?
Doing the right thing.
For who?
I exhaled. In general.
So you flew to Dublin in Morrill's air, is that what you're saying?
I owe him this.
Owe him?
You owe him nothing. That's not strictly true.
Sal sighed.
Explain.
I shifted my weight. The water was going cold around me.
I did something, I said. Back then, I made a mistake.
A beat of silence.
Go on.
The reason they arrested him.
I swallowed, trying to hold back the tears that were trying to break through once again.
I think they arrested him because of me.
Allison now. I borrowed a freshly laundered t-shirt of my mother's to slip on under my grey sweater, took the time to blow-dry my hair straight, and applied a little of the expensive makeup I found in the bathroom cabinet. There was a nearly empty bottle of some floral perfume in there as well, and after a second's hesitation, I spritzed some of it on. But now,
seeing the look on the face of the uniformed Garda who'd been tasked with driving me to the CPH. I wondered if maybe I should have just changed my T-shirt and left it at that. She'd flashed her badge and ID at me. Garda Emily Cusack. Half a foot taller than me, Cusack had large blue eyes and that kind of fresh-faced, natural beauty look that I knew I'd never achieve without a makeup bag. Alison Smith, she said after I'd opened my mother's front door to her. I need you to come with me, please. I'm to escort you to the Central Psych Hospital for a patient visit. There was a squad car parked outside the garden gate with its engine running, and another uniformed Garda behind the wheel. Cusack motioned for me to get in the back on the passenger side, then sat into the seat in front of me. The central locking clicked and we drove off, tires squealing. I'd never been in a proper Garda car before, not one of the liveried ones. A clunky-looking laptop computer was mounted to the dashboard, angled towards the driver, and there was some sort of radio or walkie-talkie thing charging on the dash. I would have thought there'd be a kind of grate or perspex partition between the front and back seats, but there was none. I must watch too much TV. The two Gardaí spoke in low tones to each other up front, but not at all to me. I was grateful they took the M50 to Dundrum, reducing the awkwardness to a 20-minute drive. At the CPH, neither Shaw nor Malone was anywhere to be seen, but I'd been expecting that. Malone had called to say they were tied up with the missing girl, and he'd check in with me later. In the meantime, I was to meet Will as planned, and try to convince him to talk to them as soon as they had a chance to talk to him. Everything was different this time around. I had to produce ID, have my photo taken, pass through a metal detector and submit to a pat-down by a security guard. My bag and phone were placed in a locker, but I was, inexplicably, given the option of keeping small change on me. I was brought to a waiting room where I was surprised to find a man standing with a dog on a leash, until the dog started circling my legs and I realized he was working. I felt bewildered by all this, and confused as to why this was my third visit, but my first time experiencing any of it. A few minutes later, the door to the waiting room opened and a familiar face walked in. "Alec," I said, relieved. "Welcome back." He shook my hand. "You get the full visitor experience this time." "Yeah, I noticed," I said. "But why?" "Well, it's been in the papers, hasn't it? There's no point in special measures anymore. We're going to put you in the visitor's room this time. You're entering the main area of the hospital, and you'll be in a space where other patients will be after you leave, so we've had to process you like we would any other visitor. The director has granted an exception for you to visit outside of regular hours, but other than that," Alec winked, "you're not a VIP anymore. Sorry." Using his staff keycard to open various locked doors along the way, Alec led me through the building and into a glass corridor, which formed a connection between the main building and another smaller, newer one behind it. A security guard there checked my name against a list on his tablet computer, and judging by the way he peered at me, matched me to the photograph they'd taken back at reception as well. Then, into the visitor's room, a huge open space that reminded me of the PE hall at school, or a local community centre. Breeze block walls painted magnolia, overly bright fluorescent lights, navy and blue checkered carpet tiles. A number of tables paired with four chairs each, 8, I counted, were spread around the room and away from each other, all unoccupied. There were 2 vending machines in a far corner, and set into the back wall, some kind of hatch or service counter with its shutters rolled down. A security camera was mounted in each corner of the ceiling, and a heavy-set security guard stood against the opposite wall. She had her arms folded and was staring right at me, coldly. "Anywhere you like," Alec said, "but visitors must sit facing the door. During the visit, physical contact must be kept to a minimum. A hug, hello, and goodbye is okay, but keep it to that. Normally, we'd have teas and coffees available, but as this is outside regular hours, you're stuck with the vending machines. If you use them, you can get something for Will, but he must remain seated. The patient can't move around the room. Do not attempt to pass the patient any other items.
If you have any, you must declare them to security and submit them for screening. They will then determine their suitability and, if approved, give them to the patient. Any questions?
It sounded like Alec had, at some point in this speech, slipped into reciting a spiel he knew off by heart.
Are you staying? I asked. I'm going to get him now, but yeah, I will. Have a seat.
I picked the closest table, the one furthest from the guard, and hung my jacket over the back of the chair. My mouth felt bone dry. I wished I'd brought in some water. There were probably bottles of it in the vending machines, but I didn't want to draw the guard's ire by getting up again so soon. I ran my tongue around the front of my teeth, licked my lips to moisten them. The dryness was spreading to my throat, tickling the back of it. About 3 minutes later, Alec returned with Will in tow. He wasn't restrained in any way. I was beginning to understand that it was the building itself that was tasked with that. I hadn't noticed on previous visits, and maybe it was just because now I was watching him walk across a room to me, but he was in normal clothes, jeans and a dark blue t-shirt, with some kind of print splashed across its middle. I wondered where his clothes came from. Could he buy things in here? If so, where did he get the money from? I'd asked him practically nothing about what his life was like. All I knew about it had been volunteered by him. He was smiling at me, pleased to see me, and clearly a lot more alert and upbeat than he'd been when I'd last met him. That's what I was thinking when, instead of stopping at a seat on his side of the table, he kept coming, around to mine, arms lifting away from his sides, and on autopilot, I pushed back my chair, stood up, turned to him. Will wrapped his arms around me, dipping his head, turning his face into my neck so I could feel his breath on my skin, and the heat of him through the thin material of his t-shirt. For a moment, I froze with the shock of it. In the next, I forgot myself. I put my arms around his waist. I turned my head to press my right cheek against his chest. I closed my eyes, breathing him in. I heard him breathing me in, a long, deep breath in through his nose. I longed to let go, to let the edges of us blur and merge, to lift my face to his. It wasn't about him. It was about having someone, being with someone, and he was all I really had to remember of that. The security guard coughed pointedly, and I pulled away, embarrassed.
You okay?
Will said in a whisper reserved for when you're only inches from the person you want to hear you. The intimacy of it was disorientating. I nodded.
Yeah.
Take your seats, the guard commanded. Alec had taken up a position directly opposite the guard, against the other wall. So we had one of them on either side, but we were much closer to Alec and still a few feet from both.
I recognize that jumper, Will said, sitting down across from me. That can't be the same one, though, surely.
It is, actually. I looked down at it. It was at my parents' house, packed away. I didn't bring enough clothes with me, so I threw it on.
Did you find the photos?
Yeah. Yeah, I found one.
With the CCTV guy in it? Really?
Yeah, I think so.
Can I see it?
The Gardaí have it, I said.
So who is he then?
I don't know. I found him in a photo of us on a night out, in a club, with Liz and two girls whose names I don't remember. And that guy. That guy had his arm around Liz. Will frowned.
Like they were together?
I don't remember her seeing anyone at St. John's.
But one of us must have known him if we were out with him, right?
Well, one of us in the picture, I said. He could be a friend of one of the other girls. Will asked me to describe the guy as he appeared in the photo, and then the two girls as well. When I was done, he shook his head.
I've no idea who any of those people are. When can I see the photo?
The Gardaí want to be the ones to show you. They want to talk to you, Will. Formally. An interview. And they'd like it if, when they ask you questions, you answer them.
Nope, he said flatly. Not happening.
Why not?
Because I'm guessing Detective Sergeant Jerry Shaw is involved.
He's a sergeant now.
I didn't know. He made a point of telling me when they came to see me last week.
And you don't want to talk to him?
He's the reason I'm in here. He's the one who bullied that confession out of me.
Will folded his arms. They searched my room this morning. Confiscated half my stuff. I bet that's his doing as well.
They're just trying to catch this guy, Will.
I bet.
I glanced at our audience, gauging how well they could hear from their positions. Then, at a volume I judged low enough not to be overheard, but not so low as to make it obvious that I was aiming for that, I said,
"There's been another one. A St. John's first year is missing."
His eyes widened.
"Since when?"
"I don't know any more details than that. All I know is Shaw and Malone found that out at lunchtime today."
"Jesus Christ," Will spat. "What are they doing out there?"
He exhaled.
"I don't get it. That's three now. Why didn't they stake out the canal or impose a curfew? Didn't they do that with us?"
"As far as I remember, we all kicked off about the curfew," I said. "And I don't know if this girl's disappearance even involves the canal."
Will shook his head.
"It's ridiculous. Do they have anything?"
"I don't know."
"What's in the news?"
"I haven't seen any."
A shadow crossed Will's face.
"Didn't you look up that website?"
"What website?"
"The one I asked you to. The one that John told me about."
"I'd clear forgotten about it." "Sorry, I haven't had a chance yet. I was only here last night."
"What about the letter?"
"What was I supposed to do about that?"
Will sighed, frustrated.
"Find out about it."
"How?"
"I don't know. Why don't you ask one of your little Garda friends?"
A beat passed.
"Sorry," Will said then. "Sorry, it's just... I'm just frustrated. I can't do anything. I'm powerless in here."
"It's not all plain sailing for me out there," I said. "The press found out about us meeting. They're calling it a date. And there's at least one newspaper this morning with my picture splashed all over the front page."
Will's face fell.
"Shit. Yeah, it is. This is my fault. I asked you to come here."
"It's not all you. I could have said no."
"Why didn't you?"
I shifted in my seat. Glanced at Alec, at the guard.
"Because I felt guilty."
"Ali, look. I get it. I understand. I couldn't at the time, but looking back now,